106.
I looked up and saw these aircraft beginning to do their attack, and lo and behold, they were going to hammer my position with no doubt. And I was in two minds. What do I do? Here I am out in the open. Am I going to run back to my post? Am I going to run for company headquarters? Or do I lay down in a hole if I can find one? I decided, of course, that I would make for company headquarters. And I did so with great speed, to put it mildly, and eventually arrived there and dived for one of the slip trenches there, and just waited while this was going on 500 yards to the front of me. Eventually, when the noise had abated and the aircraft had droned away, we poked our heads above the area, above the slit trenches, and all I could see was my position covered in just dense sand, blast, smoke, and goodness knows what. And I thought, oh my God, what the hell has happened? So I said to the sergeant major, I said, look, I must go back and see how it was. Well, it's unbelievable. I got back there, and a lot of these posts were made by the Italians, were concrete. They had deep concrete covers, underground, sort of dug in, which was, to a certain degree, fairly bomb-proof. And most of the lads had taken shelter in those shelters. But as I approached my post, the first thing I saw at the gap that I had to go through to get into it properly was one mighty great unexploded bomb. I think it must have been a good 500 pounder, and or whatever the Stukas dropped, about that, I should think. And I thought, oh my goodness, I stood there and hesitated. Now, am I going to go past this thing or am I not? Well, I had to, didn't I, to get in. And I went in and saw the lads, and they were all right. There was no casualties, but they were a little bit shaken up because of the closeness of the bombing. But they withstood it fairly well. And except for all my earthworks that we'd made for additional gun positions being destroyed and that sort of thing, which we set to and put right, there was no further harm. But that was the general existence from day to day in Tobruk, and these patrols. Now, I have to tell you one experience of patrolling where I'd made a bit of a pig's ear of things as the patrol commander. I'd received the briefing to take out a reconnaissance patrol of about 10 men and myself, and go to a certain position out in, if you like, no man's land, or near the enemy positions, to see if I could identify where their positions were and what was there. Now, you have to remember, this was at night time, and on this particular night, it wasn't a moon night, it was moonless. So one could see, but not quite so well as one might do. And my company sergeant major and the colour sergeant had been rather generous in the tot of rum that he'd given everybody. And one or two lads had swiped it back and developed a little bit of hiccups. Now, when you go out onto patrols, particularly a reconnaissance patrol, silence is one of the things that you sort of need more than anything. You have to approach the place with great caution and as quietly as you possibly can, so that you can, if you can, able to take in everything that you should do. And halfway out, this happened, and I thought, now what do? I can't take these blokes any further. I don't think it was through any courageous thoughts on my part, but I decided that I would send the patrol back under the corporal, and I'd try and go ahead on my own and probably stand a better chance of seeing what I was sent out to do. And so I did this. The corporal, I gave him the compass, and said to him, take the patrol back, tell them what I'm trying to do, and I'll get back, but please wait for an hour, and give me an hour. Now, whether he waited an hour or not, I don't know, but I never did meet up with him again on that patrol. I did go forward. I did identify the sound and location, roughly, of what might be going on. I noted what I could, but I didn't see anything. It was a question of listening, and I began to get a little bit worried because I was on my own. I thought, well, if I get too deeply embedded, I might not get out. So I decided then to crawl back, hopefully to rejoin the patrol. And I did. I went back for a little while, and there was no sound, no sign. Contrary to all instructions and that, I did call out several times, but there was no response. And so I thought, well, I'll head back to my main position in Tobruk. Now, one might ask, well, how the hell are you going to get back there if you haven't got a compass? Well, we did and were taught to read the stars to a certain extent, very briefly, and how to pick up the North Star. And in that particular position, if you picked up the North Star and you headed that direction, you could absolutely, with absolute certainty, come up against the defences or the outer defences of Tobruk. Exactly where was another problem. And this is where I landed in a wee bit of trouble, because I'd got back to a main track running sort of round, roughly parallel with the perimeter. And I thought, now, am I going to go right or am I going to go left? I chose the wrong way and went left, and eventually finished up in one of these minefields and successfully sent one off. But fortunately, it didn't do me any damage except to frighten me. And so I said, well, caution is the thing here. And I just lay down for the night, put my head in my steel helmet, and tried to rest until daylight, when I said to myself, right, now if I stand up, I'm bound to attract somebody in the perimeter. There was the equal danger also, of course, of being caught in one of the early artillery bombardments that the opposing forces visited us with every morning. So I thought, well, the lesser of two evils. However, I did. I stood up, and eventually it turned out that I was close to my own place, but not quite close enough. I was outside A Company, and there was a Sergeant Booker, was the chap who heard me and told me to stand absolutely still. I was in the minefield. I said, well, I know that. You're going to have to tell me. He said, I'll send out a party to guide you in. And I did. But the final consequence of that patrol story is that I was rather severely choked off by the commanding officer for leaving the patrol. I should have kept it with me. Or I should have brought it back and said, there's no way could I go ahead and do it. I thought it was rather a little bit hard, really, because it turned out to be that the information that I was able to supply, although not very detailed, was almost exactly as I tried to paint the story. And I discussed it with my company commander later on at the time, and he said, yes, he said, I remember it. He said, but we didn't believe it, you see. And thereby hangs a story of that nature. But I was severely choked off for doing it, because it was against all the principles and conduct of a patrol commander. But it was done, there it was, wasn't it? I learnt. And so that really brings us up to the closer to the breakout period. And General Auchinleck was commanding the 8th Army then, at that particular time. And they had decided that they were going to put in a main effort from the main front down near what's the name of the little port I just said? St. Omer down to Hellfire Pass, Saloum, from the Saloum area. And they're going to put in a main attack there and make their approach to the perimeter of Tobruk. And at the same time, the main forces in Tobruk, the Tobruk garrison, were to break out themselves and meet up with the main force. But things went wrong. And the main 8th Army, as it was called then, came up against rather stiffer opposition somewhere in the Bardia region, and were unable to make the progress that they wanted to join up with us. In the meantime, we had commenced the breakout from Tobruk. And
that, you mean the Second Queen?
Yes, yes. Well, the whole Tobruk garrison, of which the Second Queen's was a part of. For instance, the Black Watch were there. We had a fairly sized, the Essex Regiment, I think, were there. The Northumberland Fusiliers, which was a machine gun battalion, and also a very strong Polish contingent were there as well, all forming this garrison that relieved all the Australians because they had to go home. Now, the main offensive started about the 24th of November from the main front, but it wasn't until about somewhere towards the end of that first week that we eventually sallied forth from Tobruk, having deemed it safe to say that by the time we'd had obtained our objectives, the main force would have joined us. But they didn't. And suddenly the Tobruk garrison was out on a limb, outside the perimeter, and we'd attacked several of the of their outposts, as they were called to them, places like Bondi, which was an Australian, the Australians gave it the name, which didn't succeed. A Company suffered rather heavy casualties when they were sent out to attack, I think it was a place called Tiger. I can't be quite sure of that from memory at the moment, but they were sent out on the heels of the Black Watch. The Black Watch suffered fearful casualties on the breakout, and A Company of the Two Queens also suffered fairly heavy casualties in their attack and eventually were withdrawn. The remaining companies were awaiting the call to go out. Now, my own B Company then were sent forward on the heels of A Company to take over and capture a place called Tugan East and Tugan West. And this they accomplished. Then they were sent further forward, and C Company were sent out to take over Tugan and in preparation for putting an attack in on this place I just mentioned called Bondi. Now, it was then when we arrived at this place called Tugan that I began to see the picture that I thought that I saw on that patrol, because I could relate to the digging and the noising going on and the fact that I seemed to be in the middle of it all, but not close enough to identify any of it. And we'd had a different company commander by then, so it was a different story. But we went into Tugan, and then it became our turn, C Company, to attack this place called Bondi. Now, this is all part of the battles that was taking place outside the Tobruk perimeter by the Tobruk garrison and hopefully waiting for the main forces to come and join us.
This is December.
Yes, yes, yes. Late November, early December, first week in December. And those little battles, things were becoming very, very dicey. Rommel was digging in his heels. He was causing chaos here, there and everywhere, as he was wont to do. And we were told to attack this place called Bondi. It was a night attack, and it ended up in complete and utter failure. We advanced towards the place, but they put up I think it was more a rear party or rear defence opposition. But we just walked into a hail of machine gun and mortar gun fire, which they brought down on all the defended localities in and around the area, and there was no way could we get through. So we just had to withdraw and go back into Tugan. We lost several men on that particular episode, and
what are your own personal memories of the attack?
Well, just coming on to this, while we were advancing, we were straight under this. Now, this is really the first time that I'd come under very close small arms and mortar fire. The amount of cover was almost nil. You just had the open desert, and all that we knew, because it was strange territory to us in that respect, we hadn't been over it before, was if you saw a piece of camel thump horn or camel thorn in a hump around a little bit of a ridge in the desert, you used it as, and you laid as low as you could. And all you could do was lay there and just listen to this stuff whistling over your head, the mortar bombs exploding around you, and thinking, well, what the God's name am I going to do now? What did we do? We were just waiting for somebody to say, well, what do we do? And in the darkness, of course, that's even more difficult. So eventually, I said to one of the lads in my platoon, I said, I don't think we need to stay here very much longer. I think we'll just make a dash out to the right flank a little bit. And that we did. I don't think it improved the situation very much, but we accomplished that little hop of about 50 yards or more, not much more. And whilst laying down there, a runner came to me to say, company commander is holding an O group, at which he disappeared. And I thought, well, where's this O group going to be? Because an O group means that, I think you might know, is that all your minor commanders, like patrol, platoon commander, sergeant, whatever it was, would go to him to receive orders for what might happen. But there was no way did I know where he was, and the runner just didn't seem to know. He just disappeared. I think he wanted to get into a hole or something. Anyway, I never did get to that O group, and I just laid there waiting to think, well, if any orders are coming, we'll receive them. And during that time, one or two others did get to the company commander's O group. Company commander was Captain P.R.H. Keeley. He's died now. And an officer by the name of Armstrong, Captain Armstrong, had just joined us from base. He just got married. Hadn't been married more than a week. He joined us, and he went to this O group. I don't know how he got the message, but he got there to the O group. And whilst they were holding the O group, a mortar bomb just landed very close by, and Captain Armstrong was no more. He just literally blew his head off. That's how close everything was. In the meantime, all this machine gun fire and that was going on around us as well. As I mentioned earlier, it was a sort of a rear guard action by the Germans. We hadn't realised it at the time, but things quietened down, and then the company commander decided that we would withdraw back into Tugan, which we did, we did a roll call, and it was then that I discovered that I lost two or three of my own platoon, so close to me that it's unbelievable that one didn't get hit themselves. One of my corporals, a Corporal North, who was laying quite close to me, within an area of this room, for instance, and yet I never heard him go. The subsequent examination showed that he'd received a bullet straight through the steel helmet, right through, so he must have lifted his head when the stuff was coming over, and he just cease to exist. Little sad cases when you knew the people so well. But anyway, this story about that Bondi expedition is that we withdrew into Tjugen and then had to wait until the next day when the commanding officer came out and wasn't very pleased with our performance the night before. He may be right, I don't know. But he said, right, we will take it and we'll do it in daylight. And we'll do it by the book, in daylight formation. And he detailed 12 platoon, 13 platoon to do the two forward platoons. And he said to me, Atkins, your platoon will be in reserve. He said, now I'm going to send you forward. He said, and if you get into difficulties, he said, I will ask the artillery to lay a smoke screen down so you can get out. So, well, I've yet to find a smoke screen that will stop bullets and mortar bombs. But that was his solution to the problem. But fortunately, they'd gone that night. And we just walked into Bondi unopposed the next day. Now, in the meantime, while those little things were going on, the main force was getting closer, and there was some terrific battles, particularly around a place called Sidi Rizik, and that's a well-known place in Sidi Rizik. It's just a bit of desert, but there was a religious symbol, what they call a mosque-type monument there of some description. And I think it was the New Zealanders or the South Africans got an awful pasting from a counterattack by the German armoured corps, and they belted them something awful, which we were to see later on. And we could, from where we were, we could hear and see the tank battles and the general furore that was going on around that area. But eventually, I don't know really how it happened, but the 8th Army was able to overcome, and Rommel decided that he would withdraw his main force, and so they all went back. So we're now coming to perilously close to the end of the Tobruk episode. But to conclude that episode was a task that was given to the regiment that is distasteful to any infantryman, and that was to clear up, because we had no transport, and it was decided that because we were part of the Tobruk garrison, it's time they sent us back to base to rest, re-equip, etc., etc. And whilst we were waiting for transport, they said, you will go down to the Sidi Rizik area and you will pick up all our dead and bury them in a temporary cemetery in and around Sidi Rizik. Now, I can assure you that that was possibly one of the most unpleasant tasks that I, or I think anybody, has to perform. And particularly if you are an infantryman and you're still going to do some more fighting, are you, you are aware that there but the grace of God go I. And some of the sights that we saw and had to deal with, for instance, you have to remember that some of those bodies had been laying out there for 4, 5, 6, 7 days. The sun had got at them, so they were deteriorated terribly. Green, bloated, limbs hanging off, half off, no heads, half a body, goodness knows what. And we were asked to gather them in and bury them. And this we set about. And I personally, for instance, will give you an example. What I did, many other people had to do. Come across a chap who'd been killed. And to pick him up was impossible in one piece. One arm was half off, a leg was half off, hanging by just shreds of flesh. And one had to use a shovel and just chop it off. And then you'd try with another bloke, pick him up, and we took blankets with us, all we had, just some blankets, laid the main corpse into the blanket, picked up his arm, his head or his leg, whatever we had to axe off so as to pick him up, roll it in the blanket and take it up to the cemetery. If there was an identification tag, fair enough, but some cases that was not possible. That would disappear completely. And the other gruesome example was that whilst doing that job, some very senior officer, brigadier or general or somebody, came driving across the desert, saw me, and much to his surprise, I saluted him in the middle of all that sort of thing. And I'll tell you about that in a moment. He said, Sergeant, he said, some of my boys are out there in a tank, and they've been out there ever since the beginning of this little episode. He said, could you go and bring them in? Yes, okay, sir. So off we go. And, oh, my goodness me. It was, there was a crew of three, and the tank had been obviously destroyed. And there was a crew of three, the driver, the gunner, and the tank commander. The turret was to shut down, and the thing had been shut right down. And this armour-piercing shot, or whoever it was, had pierced the tank. And then all I could see when once I got the turret open was almost a little bit of a head on one side, facing that side. The gunner on the other side, or the operator, or whoever he was, with his head gone from the other side. And the whole of the middle of the tank commander's insides and legs intertwined with the two crew down below him. Remember, they'd been there for a week, so the stench was horrific. And the only way we could stand that was to get field dressing to wrap them around the nose and pull them out. We did that, got these lads out eventually, got their identifications out, and that's how we learnt that the tank commander had only just been married, had his photographs with him, just long enough to travel from England to there and bang. So there were some gruesome sights, and they live with you for the rest of your life. Don't talk about it very much, but as this is an occasion, I'm telling you. I mentioned about the general officer being surprised he got a salute. He sorted out and found out where my battalion headquarters was, and went to the commanding officer and said, I wish to compliment you on a well-disciplined battalion. I've just been saluted for the first time for many, many weeks. And the CO found out it was me, so he just said, oh, well done, Atkins. That's, you know, out of that. But interesting, isn't it, how senior officers think. It was very important that he got saluted. That, I think, brings that Tobruk episode mostly to a